You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 620. We all need mirrors to remind ourselves who we are. I am no different. Leonard from Memento.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we have blockbuster Hollywood leading man, Guy Pearce. Now, Guy has been in some legendary movies like Chris Nolan's first studio film, Memento, LA Confidential, Iron Man 3, the indie classic, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Time Machine, and many, many more. And Guy and I sat down and had a deep, deep conversation about what it takes to make it in Hollywood, his adventures in Hollywood as an actor, what he does as an actor, what he looks for in a director, what it was like working with a young Chris Nolan, and what it took to get into his new movie, The Infernal Machine, directed by Andrew Hunt, and much, much more. I mean, Guy even said at the end of this that he owed me money for a therapy session because it was such a deep and just profound conversation. So I really hope you guys enjoy it. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Guy Pearce. I'd like to welcome to the show Guy Pearce. How you doing, Guy?
I'm very good, mate. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. I'm so excited to have you on the show, man, because you've done so many movies that have touched my heart in so many ways. And I'll just tell you my quick Priscilla story. I was in film school and I went to see Priscilla in the theater and it blew my mind off. I was just like, first time I'd ever seen anything like that. I was, 20 something. And it was just, oh, God. So I wanted to thank you fantastic. For that. First of all, and then we'll get
started. Thank you. I appreciate it. And it's funny because that's the film that it's sort of the gift that keeps on giving. You know, it just came at the right time. Obviously, it was released in 94 and it obviously came at the right time. And we've had such wonderful, people sort of, commenting throughout these previous 25 years about what that film has meant to them for all sorts of different reasons. That was a real honor to be part of it. You know, as an actor, you just take on something because it feels good. But then, of course, you don't realize whether it's going to be part of a zeitgeist or just get lost in the wash. And obviously, Priscilla has stood the test of time and has touched a lot of hearts like yours.
I cannot trust me. A film like that does not get lost in the wash. It's yelling at you to like, no, you need to watch me.
That's right. Yes, it's a fairly noisy. starting off.
And Terrence and Hugo. I mean, they're to perform. All three of your performances were so magical. But even get started, I want to ask you about your performance in that because you were so fearless. And you threw yourself into that character so beautifully and in a time where it wasn't nearly as accepted. It could have pigeonholed you. It could have been like, oh, there's that dude that did Priscilla. I don't want to cast him.
kind of thing. So you just like, no, I want to do this story. How did you like, how, where did you get the, as they say in my culture, cojones to go out there and do that?
Well, the so funny,
fearlessly.
Well, a couple of things. I think I'd been doing a lot of theater since I was a kid, you know, mm-hmm. and a variety of plays and musicals and all sorts of stuff. And so I was quite used to going from one crazy character to another crazy character, whether you were playing the King of England or whether you were playing the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz or, what, you know, whatever it happened to be. And so the idea of doing things that were vastly outside of my own personal experience was something I was always excited about and something that I never felt that, I suppose on some level, I was quite an anxious kid and on many levels, getting to play these characters that were so vastly different to me was a real chance to break free from the confines of the anxious kid that I was, you know. So there was that. And the other part of it was that I'd been on a television show in Australia called Neighbours for 4 years. Yeah. And I'd played this very sort of just straight sort of suburban kid, obviously going through the ups and downs that we see in soap television. And I'd struggled a little bit after I left that show because I was pigeonholed in Australia where lots of people went, yeah, we don't really want to cast him in our movie because he's the guy from that show. And then Priscilla came along and Stefan, our director, went, nothing would be funnier than to take the guy from that show and put him in a dress. And I was like, yes, yes. So in a way, I was breaking free from the show. And to me, I didn't feel like I was necessarily doing anything brave in taking on the role in Priscilla. I was just getting to kind of break some shackles. I mean, in line with what you'd said, I mean, you know, obviously my first film in America was L.A. Confidential. And a lot of people said to me, how on earth did Curtis Hanson cast you after seeing Priscilla? Well, the answer was Curtis never saw Priscilla and he didn't want to see it. because he kept being told, you know what guys like in Priscilla? Are you sure this is the guy you want to play a 50s LA cop? So I was really lucky that thankfully Curtis didn't go to the Cinerama Dome for the opening of Priscilla in 1994. And, you know, otherwise he would have wiped me off the slate, I reckon.
And I'm assuming it's kind of like when a comedian wants to do drama, they want to kind of break through the shackles like a Robin Williams or Jim Carrey, that they have to break through the perception of what people are. And in your world, you were the guy from Neighbors and you needed to break. And yeah. Priscilla definitely broke that mold.
Well, and I wasn't even necessarily looking to break the shackles. It's just that film came along and I was offered it. And as soon as I read it, and it wasn't even so much about trying to break the shackles, honestly, it was this, that I was so moved by the script and I just saw how I could play that character. And I just genuinely just went straight into it. Like I do with any other job that I take on, you know, it's because I respond to a script and I respond to a character and go, oh yeah, I can see what I could do with this. The same as when I was doing plays and musicals when I was a kid, going, oh yes, I could take on playing Julius Caesar, of course. You know, so it's that same kind of childlike use of your imagination that enables me to keep doing what I do, I suppose. And there's plenty of films and scripts that I read and go, no, I just can't see myself, or it's, I don't quite believe it, or I'm not quite sure that I could do this successfully. So, you know, there's plenty of things that I say no to, but when I find something to say yes to, it's a great feeling.
And with Priscilla, I mean, I'm assuming that was the movie that kind of broke you out of the Australian market in a way, because it was an international success.
Absolutely, particularly in America. I mean, the TV show Neighbours was really big in England and in Europe, so lots of people there knew us from that show. But Priscilla went to America and we went to America with it. It actually went to Cannes first and I couldn't go because I was on another TV show in Australia and I couldn't go. But it had a huge success in Cannes, lots of publicity surrounding it. Then when it got released in America a few months later, I then did get to go, went to the opening, and that enabled me to get an agent in America and then start auditioning for things there. And, you know, within a year, because at the end of 95, I landed the role I auditioned for LA Confidential, and at the start of 96, I got the role, and then we filmed it in sort of May of 2006. So really within a year, so that it, there's some very clear sort of steps that thankfully were laid out in front of me that meant that I was then able to start working in the States. And the beauty was really, you know, Curtis might not have seen Priscilla, but lots of other people had.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then they saw LA Confidential. And so that on some level established a kind of a what was wonderful for me, which was, right, you're a versatile, you want to be a versatile actor. I went, yes, absolutely. And so people on one hand were going, how can that guy from Priscilla be that same guy from LA Confidential? So I felt really fortunate that that paved the kind of paved the way for future work, you know.
Now, when you were first starting out, and this is something that, I mean, actors have to deal with, I think almost more so than any other creative in our industry, is the no's and the rejection constantly. And I'm assuming when you first started, I'm assuming in the first audition you walked into, you're like, you come in. Yeah, let's just give you the part. Yeah. How much money do you want? You could all the money you want. I'm assuming this is not the normal route that you went at the beginning.
No. And I mean, I got really lucky. The thing was, you know, as I said, I've done theater for about 10 years from when I was sort of 8 till I was 18. And in that whole time, in different theater companies in the town that I was growing up in.
Sure.
And in the whole time, it was made very clear to me that this is a tough industry. Most of the time you're out of work. You know, you really, it's competitive and good luck. And I never really had tickets on myself. I never really thought I was anything special. You know, I have a sister with an intellectual disability, so I'm very aware growing up that the world is unfair. And I thought, I just really enjoyed what I was doing. I really got something out of being in the theatre. And I would look at those incredible actors that I would see on screen, like Brando and Pacino, and then, of course, in later years, Gary Oldman and Russell Crowe and all these incredible actors, and think, they're so incredible to me, but I know I'm not them. And any job that I get is a bonus. Any work that I get is just, I'm really grateful for. I have an enormous amount of gratitude. Of course, over the years, I've gone, okay, well, I must have something that I offer, and there must be something believable about what I'm doing because I keep getting work, you know. And so I suppose I've just always been really grateful for the shifts and changes. And, you know, when Neighbours came along, it was just an incredible lucky break because I was finishing high school, talking to my high school drama teacher about going to NIDA, which was the National Institute of Dramatic Art, the big theatre school in Sydney, which I did audition for. I didn't get in. I got down to like the last three on the day, and they basically said, you're a bit young, go away, have some life experience and come back. And right around the same time, I'd done an audition for Neighbours, and they offered me a 6-week role, and then a couple of days later they turned that into a year before I'd even started. So this all sort of happened really quickly. So I was going, but all those things that people said about not ever getting any work, well, okay. So I realised I was extremely lucky that that happened. You know, that I thought, wow, okay. And when people say to me, lots of young actors and kids and, you know, say, what sort of advice have you got? I'm like, get lucky because, you know, learn your lines, turn up on time, have a very professional work ethic and get lucky because, you know, there's plenty of wonderful actors that I know at home who haven't had the breaks that I've had. I don't want to be self-denigrating, but they're much better than I am. You know, they're amazing. And I just think, okay, something just lined up in the universe that meant I should get on that show. I learned what I learned from that show. I then got Priscilla. From Priscilla, I got an American agent. From that, I got LA Confidential. And they'll just go, okay, be grateful for all these steps along the way because they could easily be taken away, you know?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It's because I've talked to so many, you know, high-performing actors and directors and writers, and I always love studying the path. Because everyone's got a different path. No one has the same path. You can't copy somebody else's path. But the thing I do notice, luck, it's a lot to do with it, but also preparation for that luck to happen. You had done 10 years of theater. You were got your chops ready. You were good. And if you had just started at 18, you wouldn't have gotten Neighbours.
No. And I think also, you know, the other thing about doing Neighbours was the show had been on another network. It was on Channel 7 here in Australia. I'm in New Zealand now, but it was on Channel 7 in Australia, and it was on for 6 months and it didn't work, so they axed it. Then the marketing people at Channel 10 said, we'll take that show because we know exactly how to market it and turn it into a big, and that's when I started. I started the first episode of Channel 10. So they marketed the hell out of it. We did lots of publicity. People came out of that show like Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue. We were all there at the same time. we worked our asses off, and the show became a huge success in Australia. And then, of course, it launched in the UK. So we had to deal with, as an 18-year-old, becoming suddenly very well known. And that in itself, you know, the acting part wasn't hard. That was the hard stuff. The hard stuff was dealing with fame and just overwhelming kind of recognition. That was tricky. And I think, you know, all sorts of aspects of my childhood and my upbringing helped me get through all that. And all those things still help me get through everything that I deal with today. But, you know, I see lots of young kids, you know, I see some kid who gets on a show and they become a huge star. And of course, in today's day and age, the mechanism to make somebody famous is they've worked it all out. You know, go bang, bang, bang. There he is, superstar. And you think, oh, wow, how's this kid going to handle this?
That's so interesting because, you know, when you're older, you have life experience. You have, you know, you can handle that kind of that fame. But when you're 18, you're a knucklehead. I was a knucklehead. I mean, we're all knuckleheads at 18.
So to
be able to, you actually work through that and survived it is pretty remarkable, to tell you the truth.
One of the things also that kind of helped really was that Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue, they were kind of in the forefront of it. They were the golden couple on the show. And there were 20 others of us in the cast, because in the show, it's set around a street. So there's like four families. So there's basically 20 to 30 other cast. So it wasn't just me in the firing line. I was part of a group. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was able to sort of just be there, but not having to sort of take the full load, so to speak, all the time. And I think that helped as well. But still, you know, we'd turn up in a shopping center and 6 million teenagers rip your clothes off. So we still had to deal with that stuff, you know, and I'd just sort of go home and quietly be on my own and play the guitar and play the piano and go, it's okay. It's okay. It's just all part of it, you know. And in a way, you know, what it's done is having fame, experiencing fame, and also experiencing rejection as far as not getting a role, both of those things are extreme and don't necessarily speak to who you are as a performer, as an artist, and what it is that you're able to offer. So it enabled me, I suppose, to really focus on why I want to do what I want to do and to just hone the craft, so to speak, because all that other stuff is going to, you've got no control over that stuff, whether you reject it or whether you become famous. Just handle them both well if you can and keep being disciplined and work on the craft and learn your lines and turn up on time and don't bump into the furniture and, you know, et cetera. So I think I've prided myself on being responsible and handling the career well. And in fact, I'm working with Jackie McKenzie at the moment, an extraordinary Australian actress. I'm here in New Zealand doing a film with Lee Tomahori. Mm-hmm. And her and I had some big stuff to do the other day in a scene. And I said, it's amazing, isn't it? Because there were some distracting things going on. It wasn't their fault, but there were some distracting things going on with the crew around us, having to hold lights and move this and et cetera. And I said to her, it's not the acting that's the hard stuff. It's trying to maintain your composure acting when you've got all this stuff going on around you. That's the hard stuff. That's where I think as an actor you come through and you shine. Because, you know, in your own lounge room, I'm great in this lounge room on my own when I'm practicing my monologue. You know,
right.
Put me in front of 50 crew and suddenly I'm a crumbling mess. You know, I've got to really kind of get it together. So there's all sorts of things in this industry that are tough. But at the same time, as I say, I'm blessed. I'm lucky. I've had great opportunities and I don't take any of it for granted.
Now, there was a little movie you did with a second-time director back in the early 2000s. Nolan, I think, was his name. I'm not
Chris,
sure. Chrissy?
I'm not sure. I don't know that he ever went on to do anything.
He never did anything else after that.
No, he was a nice guy, though. He was a nice guy.
First sweet, sweet guy. Didn't know what he was doing, but sweet. No, I mean, Memento. I mean, when you did Memento with Chris Nolan, I mean, this was his first, it was his first real movie. He'd done Following, but
that's
then this
right.
was
he'd the- done Following, which he basically shot himself in London, I think.
Right.
So yes, that's right. So Memento is the first sort of film produced kind of production type
with real crew and real everything. And he's a young guy, and the script is insane, and it goes backwards.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And you, I mean, when you, how do you approach something that hasn't been done before with a unknown, essentially unknown director, writer? I'm assuming you felt out the genius in the script and you felt out the genius in Chris when you met with him. But tell me, what was that process like?
It was incredible, really, because it, as much as I say that, you know, I'm really fortunate to get any work that I get. And if someone says no, and I don't get to be in a film, and I sort of go through that process and learn to accept that, there are certain films along the way or certain jobs along the way that if I didn't manage to get, I know I'd be really sad about. And that was one where I got sent the script by my agent, and he'd written a note at the start of the script just saying, by the way, this all goes backwards, which was the best thing he could have done, because at least I approached it going, okay, I don't know what we're in for here. I read it and I immediately felt empathy, and I felt the emotional journey of this character, even though it was kind of all over the place. So I immediately connected with that. I think within a day I got to see Following, and I had the most overwhelming feeling of, I have to do this movie. Like, I really have to do this film. This is just, you know, I'm all over this. I know exactly what I could do here. Obviously, there's a lot for me to learn as far as what the story means, et cetera, but I just felt really keen to do it. And I met with Chris, and it's the only time I've ever, you know, you hear these stories of actors and film directors saying, oh, man, he was so passionate about the project. He slept on my front porch for days and just said, I'm the only guy to play this role. And, you know, the passion was there. And clearly that indicated to me that he was the guy. And I've always thought to myself, aren't you just, you're either the right actor or you're not the right actor. If you go to the meeting, then it's obvious that you're keen to do the role. But I thought, I never want to do any of that kind of stuff where I'm trying to prove to somebody how keen I am to do their movie. I should cast me because I'm right, not because I'm more passionate than the next guy.
Right, right.
But I said to Chris Nolan, I sort of called him up, I think, after I'd met, and said, look, I'm really sorry to do this, but just to let you know, if it means anything at all, I really want to do this film. I'm so sorry to sort of bug you with this, because he wasn't that kind of guy either. He's quite a professorial Englishman, you know, this whole sort of approach that other people had taken, I can't imagine would really work for Chris. So I was quite apologetic in my call. And in the end, I got the role, but I don't think it was because I called him to say how passionate I was. I think. There was no question for me about him being a first or second time director. I mean, I still felt like a budding actor myself anyway. So clearly, looking at Following, there's just no question that he's somebody who is utterly capable, beyond capable. So there was just no question that I wanted to do it. And I was very excited when I got cast. And the process of then working with Chris, we did a couple of weeks rehearsal, and of course I then got to understand the script even more, was just extraordinary. It really was. And it was a very economic shoot. We did it all in 5 weeks, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful also because Chris, you know, here he is, the one side of his brain is writing this amazing deconstructed story that perplexed audiences all around the world to the point where they had to go straight back in the cinema and watch the film again.
Right.
And on the other side, he writes this incredibly sensitive, beautiful, emotional story about a man who's trying to hold himself together with this, you know, failed memory. And I just thought the ability for him to do those two things, and then on set, for him to be all over all the technical stuff, just absolutely naturally, and at the same time be talking to me about the specifics and the nuances of psychology and behavior and performance, I was like, wow, this guy is a master. I mean, so I was really fortunate to be there in the early days with Chris Nolan. And of course, we've all seen what he's gone on to do.
He's doing okay. He's doing okay for himself at this point.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, he's one in a generation. He's one of those directors, those creatives once in a generation that comes along, because when you have someone who you can't do, there's nobody else that could do a Chris Nolan film. Like, it's so specific. It's like a Spielberg. Like, there's nobody who could do a Spielberg film.
That's right. And talking about films, you know, that sort of gifts that keep on giving, like Priscilla, I mean, Memento does as well in a totally different way. I get film students all over the world for the past 20 years emailing me and, you know, sending messages through my agent or whatever saying, we are studying your film at film school. What Chris Nolan did is like nothing else. And so I really have understood more and more over time the genius of this film. At the time, of course, when I start any film, any job, I'm so focused on obviously the bigger picture, the story of the film, et cetera, but what it is I've got to do, what my task is, what, you know, how I get inside the head of a character and inside the heart of a character. So I'm focused so much on that I'm not really thinking about how the film's going to be perceived by the public later on. You know, hopefully they have the reaction that I had when I read it. But it's quite a selfish pursuit, to be honest, when I read something and go, oh, like when you read a book and you put it down and you can't stop thinking about it. That's the reaction that I have if things are great. So, and then, of course, it's not until it's released and then the whole world starts going, oh, wow. And I go, oh, really? Yeah, wow. Okay, I'm on board.
Let's go for the ride. Now, yeah. I know, now that you've had the career that you've had so far in life, is there something that you wish you could have gone back and said to your younger pre-Neighbors actor self? Like, you know what? Just prepare yourself for this.
I think it's, you know, I mentioned my anxiety before. I think if there was something I could have gone back and said that would have alleviated some of that, you know, and that anxiety sort of comes back. You know, I'm battling with it all the time. Not battling, that's too strong a word, but I'm
dealing with it.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't go away. Obviously I've gained more confidence as years have gone on, and I wasn't just anxious about whether I was any good as an actor. I was just an anxious kid. I lost my dad when I was really young, and I helped raise my sister who, as I say, has an intellectual disability. And I think I felt a lot of pressure to be I don't know. I think I feel quite self-conscious about not being smart enough, not being clever enough, not being all these things. And so I wasn't a very relaxed kid. You know, I was just on the lookout. I mean, I can spot something a mile away. It's like I've got radar for things. So I'm quite a control freak, and I'm quite, as I say, just a bit angsty about stuff. So I've just learned over the years through lots of therapy and, you know, the work that I get to do, and now having my own child and, you know, just living the life. I mean, I'm nearly 55. Just to make the effort to just sort of calm down and you know, I want to be a responsible person, but I don't want that to sort of eat away at me, you know. And so I've made real efforts to help that. And I think if there was something I could go back and help the younger me with in his teens, rather than waiting till sort of getting through 30s and into 40s, that would be a handy thing.
And you would have said, there's going to be a script called Memento and a script called Priscilla. Do those two.
Yeah, make sure you do them. Yeah. The other one that sort of came along that I nearly didn't do, well, it was this, that after I had a real breakdown at the end of 2001, I'd started working in America, as I said, in the late 90s. A whole lot of things sort of came crashing together. And one of those things was, I think, that I didn't really feel like I was a great actor. And I didn't, I also wasn't really sure of the validity of what I was doing. And also here I was still as someone in my late 20s and into 30 doing something based on the decision of an 8-year-old. You know, as an 8-year-old, I went and joined theatre companies, and I was still doing this stuff. And so as a 30-year-old, I was kind of questioning it all and questioning it.
Why do you think that? Is it because of the fame? Is it because of the work? Because did you not enjoy it?
No, I had realized I had started to get pretty grumpy going to work every day. And I found I was a bit short with people and I just wasn't very pleasant. And I really started to go, I got to do something about this. I'm, you know, all this anxiety stuff that I was talking about and all this sort of controlling kind of element of myself was really kind of amplifying. And the weird thing was I was getting more work, you know, so from 96, 97, 98, 99 was, you know, Memento. I did Rules of Engagement. 98, I did Ravenous. That was a tough experience, Ravenous.
Oh, yeah.
99, 2000, 2001, I did Count of Monte Cristo and The Time Machine that started to do big films, you know.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And the machine of Hollywood, as well as just me not handling Hollywood very well, I think the sort of slightly competitive nature of it, as I think ultimately just not feeling like I deserved what was actually happening, basically, and kind of going, I just have to step away from it all. I just need to step away. So at the end of 2001, I decided to take a year off. I thought, that's it. I have to get away because I'm just getting really grumpy on set. What's happening to me? I'm being really horrible to people. And, you know, took some time off. I did work in 2002 and into 2003. I did this Jean-Jacques Annaud film with Tigers called De Frères, or Two Brothers. But I then wanted to continue the time off after that into sort of later into 2003. And so I was just not working. I was really questioning, as I say, the validity of it, wanting to come back to it as a 30-year-old having made the decision that this is what my career was going to be, not an 8-year-old going, oh, it might be fun to be on stage. You know, I needed to sort of view it from a more mature point of view and really see that it's what I wanted to do and have some more faith in it.
Interesting.
And during that time, during that 6 months, and scripts were arriving, and I was literally getting them and putting them in a pile and ignoring them. And then at some point late in 2003 or whenever it was, I'm at home with my friend getting stoned, you know, watching a movie or something late at night. And the phone rings and I let the answering machine get it. And there's this voice going, Guy, look, I hope you don't mind that I'm calling you. It's Nick Cave here. We've sent you a script called The Proposition and they, you know, we'd love you to do it. And it seems that you're obviously not working at the moment. And they seem to think that if I call you, perhaps it might prompt you into at least looking at the script. And so, of course, there I am with my mate at home, like stone. Oh, my God, there's a script from Nick Cave. Oh, my God, we're listening to this answering machine message, you know. And that triggered me to sort of eventually go back to work again because I did read The Proposition and went, oh, my God, Nick Cave. It's like being inside a Nick Cave song. And so that sped up the process a bit. I put the marijuana away and I really enabled myself to, instead of just getting away from the industry and then not being responsible and actually doing what I wanted to do, which was think about it properly, I just kind of took a holiday. So that just woke me up and got me out of the holiday and thought, I'm going to go back to work. And when I go back to work, which was sort of the end of 2004, I'm going to approach it with a whole new attitude, which I did. And that was very different for me after that. 2004, 2005, up to 2010, and, you know, here we are now. And I really managed to handle Hollywood. I really managed to handle being there and choosing the work that I chose and giving myself the time off in between things. And because also when you do start to work in Hollywood, there is the old adage, you've got to make hay while the sun shines.
Right.
So as I started to get LA Confidential and those things, I just felt this pressure to just keep on going because it's going to go, it's going to go, it's going
to
go.
That's what the town does to you. The town does that to you.
Yeah, and as I say, I'd sort of been taught that also in theatre school when I was a kid. Like, you know, when work comes along, you got to take it because it's going to dry up any second, which is kind of true, but at the same time it can wind you up a bit, and it wound me up. And I needed to just go, no, I need to just do this the way I need to do it. And I, you know, I started, as I say, to feel more confident about my capabilities as well. So I was able to say no to things, you know.
You went on a walkabout. You went on a walkabout.
I went on a walkabout. And I actually went, at the end of 2001, I went to this really remote desert part of Australia, the northwestern point called Cape Levesque. And I spent a month there trying to learn how to meditate. And I got a handle on it after a month. But it was a tough month.
I mean, you know, sometimes you just got to, it's not something that everyone gets to experience. I mean, you had a pretty hell of a run there of movie after movie after movie. And it's not hard. It's hard for people to like, oh, you have so much success, but there's a stress with that. And there's a stress that you have to just stop from like, wait a minute, is this what I want? Because the train is moving so fast that you're like, I don't even have time. And I've heard that from so many other, from writers, from directors, from actors who just like, I gotta take a second here. Cause if not, this train's going to run me over.
Well, and the thing about, you know, the difficult thing, as I mentioned, when we were doing Neighbours, which was all the fame that came with it, but there was no other choice to make. I was just on the show, and that was what we were doing. Once I started working outside of that show and I started making films, then you're constantly faced with another choice. Do I take this film? Do I not take this? You know, and of course, right. Don't get me wrong, it's first world problems. You know, I'm
exactly. And what director should I work with? Ridley Scott, right. Or Nolan, or
leave me alone, guys. but it was amplifying my anxiety, and I had to learn how to handle it. Now, the big part in all of this that I was flippant about a minute ago was that I was smoking pot and I was smoking too much of it. Mm. And that did not help at all. And yeah. So once I gave that up in about 2005. I stopped smoking in 2005. That also changed everything. I realized that my perspective on everything, you know, I mean, as we know, drugs and alcohol are great fun, but they're not our friend at all. So that helped as well.
And you had to go through that as well. I mean, look, we all have to go through our own journeys and our own obstacles that get thrown in front of us, you know. And you know, I think to be from an outsider's perspective, you've done pretty well, sir. You've been able to navigate, and I love the parts you've done over the years, and how you approach the business, and any type of interviews I've ever seen with you, and everything. It just seems like you've gotten a handle on it. Where I've talked to others who have no handle on it, and you can see like at any second, and I'm like, oh, they're gonna crash and burn any second. Like, oh, that's not gonna go well. So it's a lesson for everyone learning, whether in the film industry or not in the film industry, whoever's listening, that sometimes you just have to take a break. And even when it's even like if you had a job that was paying you $300,000 a year, but you're like, it's so much money, but I hate what I'm doing. Do I need to stop and figure out what I really want to do is dance?
Yes, exactly. That's right. Well, the other thing for me is I play music and I write music, and that's a real passion for me. Yeah. So is acting. Mm-hmm. But once I allowed myself to really, you know, start recording music and that I was then going to release, that also helped as well. Because when I'd been on Neighbours, as people know, not so much in the States, but in Europe and Australia, Kylie and Jason became huge pop stars.
Oh, yeah.
And if ever I mentioned that my hobby or my other interest was making music, I had a lot of journalists rolling their eyes saying, oh, not another Neighbours star is going to release a single. And so I very quickly, back in 1986, went, no, I'm never going to, no, don't worry, I'm never going to make a public. Sorry, I'm never going to make a public. So I had this very private passion, which was to collect recording equipment, build a studio at home and record music at home that no one was ever going to hear. And finally, in about 2009, when I worked with Michael Barker, a wonderful drummer, on a play we were doing, we had a band in the play and we were singing songs, he said to me, you realize you are not doing yourself a service or any favors by not allowing this creative outlet out. You've got to do that. So he really encouraged me, and you know, I made a record and got it out in 2014, made another one, got it out in 2018. And so that was also a big hurdle that I, you know, that just the thing of being brave enough, or brave's not really the word, but just being strong enough to go, no, I make music and I want to get it out there. So, and that's healthy for me to do that, even if people don't really like it or whatever. Just to be able to get it out is a good stepping stone. Otherwise, you just go around in circles.
No question. Now, speaking of amazing parts, your new film, Infernal Machine, I mean, it's a tour de force performance by you, sir, without question. It is, I mean, I can't imagine this is what I always find fascinating about actors, is that you get into these parts and the insanity and the paranoia and what you were doing in Infernal Machine. How do you approach, you know, first of all, tell us a little bit about the movie, and how do you approach, like, mentally, how do you turn that off at the end of the day and not just live it?
Well, yeah, it was a tricky one with that. I mean, you know, thankfully we were in a lovely location and having a lovely relaxed time as well with some great people. But you're right, the character is pretty intense. You know, I play an ex or a writer, but someone who has written a book that's been hugely successful many years ago. But in the success of that book also came an absolute tragedy where a young man was apparently prompted by this book to go and murder a whole lot of people. And so it was a mass shooting. when he was arrested and interviewed by the police, he said, I was, you know, it was like voices in my head, and that all came from that book, The Infernal Machine, that my character had you know, written.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So obviously for that character who I played in that film, Bruce Cockburn, he's dealing with the success of this book, and he's dealing with this horrible tragedy that has occurred that's apparently his fault. And so by the time we start the film and by the time we find this character, he is now a recluse living, you know, on his own in the desert, sort of in Southern California somewhere, paranoid, really anxious, just dealing with his own demons, drinking too much, you know, just hiding out, and has been for quite some time. And he starts receiving these letters from a fan who he doesn't know. And this is the opening of our story, and this leads to all sorts of, you know, other difficulties.
Insanity.
Well, that's right. Things are exposed, and he is forced to sort of come out of his recluse kind of state. But yes, the character, it was an exhausting performance because he is quite sort of highly strung, so to speak. But, you know, like Memento, Andrew Hunt had written this amazing script that as soon as I read, and Richard Guardian, who was one of the executives on the film, who I know, called me and said, listen, we've got this script, and I think you really might like it. And we're sort of out to someone else at the moment, but have a read. And if it doesn't work out with the other actor, then, you know, let us know if you're interested. So, of course, I read it and immediately called Richard and went, so who is the other actor, in or out? Like, what? I really want to do this film. It was the same as my experience with Chris. And he said, well, let me put you in touch with Andrew, the writer-director. And we had a great chat, and it was pretty clear the other actor wasn't really fully attached. And so I managed to wheedle my way in and got to make the film with them. So another great kind of psychological expose. But an exhausting process.
Oh my God. When is that? That comes out on the 23rd, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, I think so. That's right.
It comes out on the 23rd. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker, or actor trying to break into the business today?
Get lucky.
You're like Quentin Tarantino. I saw him once, and like that same question, and they asked him, and he's like, write Reservoir Dogs. That's what I did.
I think, you know, as I say, it's a combination of discipline and being in the right place at the right time. So, you know, the thing you can control is your discipline, and really learn your lines and understand why you're doing what it is you want to do. Is it about fame, or is it about a genuine need to be creative and a genuine need to express something?
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
I think to be kind to myself. I think to be sort of, you know, and not to, I'm often focused on worrying about everyone else around me, mm-hmm. and thinking that if I was to focus on myself, then that's just selfish and self-centered. So it's taken me a long time to realize that actually I'm allowed to take care of myself and allowed to, as I say, be kind to myself, and, you know, and allow moments of self-indulgence and go, if I just want to watch the football on my own, I'm just going to watch the football on my own.
Fair enough. Now, what did you learn from your biggest failure?
Well, I have to think about what my biggest failure might be.
Anywhere.
Of course.
Project.
Of course. It could be my marriage. I think the biggest lesson always is to manage and to look at your own ego. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think my ego probably got in the way of that relationship in the end. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of,
I understand what you said, but ego,
my ex-wife would probably disagree to some degree about that, but at the same time she would go, well, yeah, maybe you do need to look at your ego. So so I think probably, you know, dealing with one's ego is a bit of
I've heard in Hollywood there's a few of those egos lying around. There's not many. I haven't met many people with egos.
Three. Yeah, there are three. Yeah, there were only two, but now there's three. Yeah. There's one on Hollywood Boulevard. There's one on Las Vegas.
One's dressed up as a Spider-Man on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right. Watch out. That's right. One drives a pink Corvette around.
Exactly. There's only a few. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Well, The Elephant Man is the one that springs to mind all the time for me. I think because of the experience that I had with my sister with a disability, it touched my heart like nothing else. I saw the film in 1980 when I was 12 when it came out, and I go back to it every year or a couple of years. I look at it again, and it's just extraordinary on so many levels. It really, really is. I'll mention a film that's actually one of my films because it's my favourite of all the films that I've done, and it is The Proposition. It's John Hillcoat's film, Proposition, that Nick Cave wrote. I think, obviously, even if I wasn't in that film, it would be one of my favourite films. It's so evocative, and with Nick's voice throughout and Nick's music and just the way in which that film was realised is really just incredible to me. Mm-hmm. And this one would be primarily because of this performance, but Brando in Streetcar. I can't, as much as we love On the Waterfront and other work of his early on, there's something about the looseness of him in Streetcar. So I don't even know if it's about that film. Obviously, it's a wonderful script. It was a wonderful play. But I just can't ever let go of that film in my head because of what he managed to do on screen.
And just as a last question about an actor to an actor, what is it about Brando that really draws every actor? I mean, every actor I've ever talked to, they're like, Brando. Or now they'd say Meryl Streep or Brando. And I go, okay, what was that map? Because he did it apparently first. He was one of the guys who just did something and everyone was like, what's going on?
Well, he clearly is clearly there's some real raw emotion that is expressed. I think at the time, of course, in the mid-50s, he brought sex to the screen.
Sure.
In a way that other actors hadn't before. He came onto the screen almost like for people just seeing a naked person on screen going, whoa, this is just way too much. There's a couple of things about Brando, and I will liken him to Tom Hardy as well. To me, Tom Hardy.
I love Tom Hardy. Oh, he's so amazing.
It's a big call, I think, to sort of put Tom Hardy in the Brando category, but I think completely deserving. And a couple of similar qualities. Brando is beautiful, as we know, very masculine, extremely handsome, beautiful, very macho, but also incredibly sensitive. There's a real delicacy to Brando, and those things feel incongruous. And of course, we all joke, we all mimic Brando, and there's that sort of that high voice that he has. so he's not doing the big, deep voice, macho kind of thing. He's part man, part woman. And to me, Tom Hardy has similar qualities. Tom is extremely beautiful, but also kind of dangerous. So these two elements are to get. So just that in itself, just looking at Tom Hardy's face is compelling. I worked with Tom in 2011, and then I went straight on and worked with Michael Fassbender and just went, okay.
Well, oh, no, yeah. Yeah.
Here's the new generation of these two guys. Wow. So I'd put Michael Fassbender up with Tom as well, but very different actors. But to me, Tom embodies a similar kind of quality that Brando does, which is this absolute masculine kind of beauty, but just this extremely delicate sensitivity. And those things, you just don't know which way any moment's going to go. And Tom, of course, is just wonderfully unpredictable and incredible.
Oh, so, I mean, when he did Brando, The Warrior, when he did The Warrior is exactly what you're, it's a complete example of what you're talking about, because it's all testosterone all the time, but man, the sensitivity, the emotion, the rawness. I saw that movie. I was just bawling at the end. I mean, bawling.
And I think that's one of the things, that's one of the lessons as an actor I would advise, particularly male actors, is find that vulnerability in yourself. Because that on screen is a winner. It's not the best way to describe vulnerability. It's a winner, but it's the best way I've come up with just now.
It's very articulate, sir.
That's right. Yeah, it's a winning move.
It's winning, man. It's good. The chicks love it.
Vulnerability, dude.
I mean, Guy, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your new film, The Infernal Machine. And thank you for all the amazing work you've done over your career and entertaining us and helping us feel and helping us navigate life through story and through performance. Well, Alex, I appreciate you, my friend.
Thank you, man. Thanks for the good, honorable questions. And it's been great to chat with you as well. And apologies for my lateness yet again.
It's all good, my friend.
I truly want to thank Guy so much for coming on the show, being so raw and honest about his journey through not only life, but through Hollywood and so much more. So thank you so much, Guy. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to see Guy's new film, The Infernal Machine, directed by Andrew Hunt, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/620. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.